From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. Mitt Romney leaves the presidential race. John McCain tries to make nice with conservative Republicans, while Mike Huckabee picks up an important endorsement. And the battle for delegates and dollars heats up between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Joining us today to talk about the latest election news is Ron Walters. He is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, and Michael Dawson, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Good to be
with you.
Thanks
for having us.
As we reported yesterday, Mitt Romney has suspended his presidential campaign. He has not endorsed anyone yet, but he did speak to the Conservative Political Action Committee. We have two clips, but you'll hear them back to back.
Frankly, in this time of war, I simply cannot let my campaign be a part of aiding a surrender to terror. I will continue to stand for conservative principles. I'll fight alongside you for all the things we believe in. And one of the things we believe in is that we cannot allow the next president of the United States to retreat in the face of evil extremism.
Now, reportedly, Ron, John McCain made a phone call to Romney shortly after his announcement. If you had to guess, what do you think was said in that conversation?
Well, I think that it's reported that he wants his support, his endorsement, his delegates. He's got about 300 delegates, and I think what eventually Mitt Romney is going to do is to keep them, because there is just a slim possibility that Mike Huckabee may come on. Mike Huckabee is playing, I think, for time. And because he is not perceived as the authentic conservative in the race, he may be able to pick up some additional delegates. Not saying that he's going to actually close that gap, but 300 delegates is a pretty good stash. And so I think that at some point, Mitt Romney wants to play them. But I'm not sure John McCain was able to talk him out of them.
Michael, James Dobson of Focus on the Family has now endorsed Mike Huckabee in a clear shot across the bow of the McCain campaign, which is an indication that GOP conservatives are still not happy with him. The president just today asking the conservatives to support the eventual party nominee without naming names, although that does look like it's going to be McCain. Bush did not reference McCain specifically. How is this going to shake out in your view, Michael?
It's going to shake out pretty poorly, at least in the short run. When you listen to people who were at the conservative convention yesterday, they're still very unhappy with McCain. Some would say they would even rather see a Clinton presidency than get out and vote and work for their presumptive candidate. I also think it means that Romney's going to hold on to his delegates. Huckabee will work harder in some of the campaigns because they might be wanting to extract something from the presumptive candidate and hold those delegates as hostage.
One of the issues is going to be how they can move toward the convention without further fracturing the Republican base. Here's McCain speaking to the conservatives just a couple of hours after Romney.
Many of you have disagreed strongly with some positions I have taken in recent years. I understand that. I might not agree with it, but I respect it for the principled position it is. And it is my sincere hope that even if you believe I have occasionally erred in my reasoning as a fellow conservative, you will still allow that I have, in many ways important to all of us, maintained the record of a conservative.
What would it take, Ron, for McCain to bridge that gap with the conservatives? Would it take a Hillary Clinton nomination, for example?
Well, that's certainly a possibility because, she, at least for the right-wing conservatives, could mobilize their base. But I just don't think that he has the time or the inclination really to bridge the gap in issue terms. I think that at some point before the convention, the inevitable was set in. And as you can begin to see now, as Michael was right, many of the conservative heads of organizations are beginning now to tack toward him. And I would expect that process will continue because they won't have a choice.
I suppose that is the next question, whether or not the Republican nominee, be it McCain or Huckabee or whomever, can they win? Can that party win, Michael, without the support of the right wing of the party?
No, they cannot win without their base energized, active, and voting enthusiastically in November. It's going to be, the last few elections have been very much based on turnout. And if they can't mobilize their key base, they're in real trouble.
Well, when do they sit down to try to work this out? And the other question is, at what point do you need to have your nominee in place to so that you can begin focusing your efforts not on each other, but on the other party's candidate?
Well, I think they would really...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think they would really like to get this settled as soon as possible, but I believe Ron was about to say, at least by the convention, they really they have to have it settled.
Well, Ron, to you, final thing about the Republicans, and then we'll start talking about the Democrats. The Republicans are holding a caucus tomorrow in Kansas, a primary in Louisiana. How significant are either of those?
I think very significant because it might begin to build a base for a post-Super Tuesday momentum for Barack Obama. He looks good in both places. The governor of Kansas has come out for him. Strong black population in Louisiana. And so it looks as though the expectations are that he will begin to win those.
Well, that was partly my question because I was going to get into the Democrats more specifically because they're holding caucuses in Nebraska and Washington State and a primary in Louisiana on Saturday, which you've already made some reference to. But let me come to you, Michael, in terms of the significance of the weekend for both Obama and Clinton to do well in those contests, especially with regard to picking up delegates.
Well, that's the key. I think what Obama really needs is to start... He needs a good rush into March 4th, because March 4th is where the Clinton campaign thinks they have their firewall, so to speak. They have they're looking towards, again, big states like Ohio and Texas to put them back on the map. But he needs to be very strong on the 9th. He needs to be strong on the 12th. And on the 19th, if he can pick up some more of the caucuses, if he can sweep the Potomac primaries, then he'll have built up the momentum, be able to raise the money that then push him through in some of the big states that he's had some problems with.
Along that same line, Ron, since Super Tuesday alone, both Democratic contenders are saying that they have raised enormous amounts of money, mostly through online support. Now, the Clinton camp reports raising about $7.5 million in the last week, $6.5 million of that in the last day and a half. But she also had to lend her campaign $5 million from her own purse. Now, on the other side, Barack Obama reported just over $7 million raised since last Tuesday, none of it from his own pocket. How important is the cost of a prolonged campaign for either or both of them?
Well, it's extremely important because I think that what happened was that the Clinton campaign sort of bet the farm on Super Tuesday. Going into January, they were about at 18.5 apiece. And they were geared actually to spend most of that in many of these states in order to come out with a stronger delegate count. The Obama people raised an enormous amount of money in January, $32 million, $1 million a day. And that gave them the capacity not only to compete Super Tuesday, but also afterward. And so I think that she's got to win. Michael was right, coming into March 4th as the firewall. The scuttlebutt is that if she doesn't do well on March 4th, there will be the drumbeat for her to get out. So she's got to spend that money that she's now raising very wisely enough to win some very important races on March the 4th.
Let me follow that point up with you with this. The superdelegates are already an issue, as we've said, because if there is a brokered convention, their votes could be key to who gets the nomination. In fact, White House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has defended the superdelegate system, but at the same time, one of those 800 or so superdelegates, strategist Donna Brazile, has said, and this is a quote, "If 795 of my colleagues decide this election, I will quit the Democratic Party. I feel very strongly about this," end quote. This is a big issue, isn't it?
It's a big issue, and it really came up during the Jackson administration. I testified before the Rules Committee to have a one-person, one-vote. They put in the 15% threshold to get delegates, and they created the superdelegates. What they wanted to do was to go back to the smoke-filled room because the party leaders, the party bosses, felt that they didn't have a role in selecting the nominee anymore. So what Donna's saying, in effect, is that if the smoke-filled room is created, and particularly if it goes against Barack Obama, he may be in second place then, it will mean it would look very bad. And this is very important because you could alienate the base of the Democratic Party going into the fall election and cost them tremendous stakes like the expansion of the party in the Senate and the House and maybe even the White House.
This is my last question. We have less than a minute. It's coming to you, Michael. I need you to give me as concise an answer as you can. What about voter fatigue? After months of political contests and media attention, will it be harder to get voters out to the polls in places like Pennsylvania in April and Indiana in May?
If the race is still close, people are going to come out. People are still energized. People are still extraordinarily interested in a very unique campaign.
So you think that that won't have much of an impact one way or the
other? Unless the race is already decided, I don't think it'll have much of an impact at all.
You share that view, Ron Walters?
Yes, I do.
All right, Michael, Ron, I want to thank both of you for coming on with us. We appreciate it. Ron Walters is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland. He spoke with us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Michael Dawson is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He spoke with us from the studios at the University of Chicago. Just ahead on our reporters' roundtable, another guilty plea in the Megan Williams case in West Virginia. She's the black woman who was held captive and tortured for days last summer by a group of whites. And our month-long series on black images in film continues. We zoom in on the serious art of black comic movies. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. And now for an update on a harrowing story we brought you several months ago. In October of last year, 20-year-old Megan Williams was found captive in a trailer in West Virginia. She had been stabbed, sexually assaulted, and forced to eat animal feces. 7 people were charged with various crimes in the case. This week, 46-year-old Karen Burton, who is white, pleaded guilty to a hate crime and other charges related to the kidnapping and torture of Williams, who is black. Burton is the only one of 7 charged with a hate crime. That's our first story on today's Reporters Roundtable. Joining us are Bob Butler, an independent journalist and president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association, Sean Gonzalez, assistant news editor for the Cape Cod Times, and Gary Harkey, a reporter for the Charleston Gazette. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Gary, let's start with you because you've been covering the Megan Williams story from the start. We mentioned at the top of the show that Karen Burton was the only one charged with a hate crime. Why is that?
It's just due to the specific facts of the case. And in her case, they had a situation where she stabbed Miss Williams as she called her a racial slur. And that alone allowed them, in that one specific instance, to say that it was a hate crime. There were other cases where Karen Burton had abused Miss Williams. She choked her with a cord, hit her, slapped her, where she was not charged with a hate crime. She was charged with, I believe it was malicious wounding. But based upon that, it was, in that case, she had, her motive was to infringe upon Ms. Williams' civil rights, which allowed them to charge her with a hate crime.
Now, we know that Williams had a social relationship with these people before this attack. Megan's mother did not initially report her missing because she had been gone for long periods of time before. And to follow that point, the victim is also described as having issues of mental competence. Does any of that complicate this case in any way?
What you have is you have 7 people, and each of them had their own motives for doing this, doing what they did to her. Bobby Brewster, who was the man that she had some sort of relationship with beforehand, Frankie Brewster was his mother, She actually got Bobby Brewster put in jail back in July, and his motive, according to the prosecuting attorney, is, you know, his motives were basically revenge upon her for putting him in jail. So every time, basically every time they would get drunk or start partying, she would be there, and he would say, you know, you put me in jail, and then attack her.
So there are still some remaining defendants to be tried or adjudicated or pleaded out in some way.
Yes, there's four people left that have not pled guilty yet, and it's hard to tell whether or not they will plead guilty or go to trial. Bobby Brewster, Frankie Brewster, Danny Combs, those are the three that had sexual charges against Megan Williams. And also there was a Lenny Burton Jr., who he had not originally been charged but is now charged with one count of misdemeanor battery.
All right. Let's move across country to another story. Bob, I'm going to bring you in to talk about this because you're covering a trial related to the murder of Chauncey Bailey. Chauncey Bailey was an Oakland journalist who was killed allegedly for looking into the inner workings of a bakery in Oakland, California, with connections to the Nation of Islam. Now, I understand that the man accused of Bailey's murder has entered a not guilty plea. What is the latest and what's going on in court today?
Well, today in court, this was actually an unrelated case, unrelated to Chauncey Bailey's murder. People at this bakery, it's called Your Black Muslim Bakery. Five of the workers, including the CEO of the bakery, were arrested the day after Chauncey was killed. They were arrested on a kidnapping and assault charge stemming from an incident last May in which they allegedly kidnapped a mother and daughter and then tortured the daughter in an effort to try to find out where a drug dealer kept his money. This was apparently an attempt to get money for the bakery. Now, this happened in May. Police did not make the arrest until August 3rd, a day after Chauncey's death. And what's happening today is the preliminary hearing is supposed to be concluding. It started last week, and there was a big surprise in which one of the defendants pleaded guilty in a very private, secret plea on Tuesday, and then came to court on Friday and announced that he had pleaded guilty and was going to testify against the other four. This has caused much consternation among the bakery people's families because in this particular case, a lot of the guy who's testifying against the CEO and one of the other defendants are all half-brothers. They all have the same father who was the patriarch of the bakery and different mothers.
Let me stop you there because it is hard to follow this, and that leads me to the question that I was going to put to both you and to Gary. And, Sean, hold on. I'm coming to you to talk about some things inside the Beltway in just a second. And my question, and the reason I stopped you, Bob, is this. How difficult is it to report information in cases like this in a way that doesn't lose the audience because of the minutia?
That's it. You know, it's difficult. I mean, as reporters, our job is to take very complicated subjects and make them simple enough for our audience to understand. In this case, it's becoming and has been very difficult because this is a story about a bakery that was once an institution in the city of Oakland that gave jobs to ex-convicts where they couldn't find work anyplace else. It's the story of a man who started the bakery who became an part of the community, and then all of a sudden find out that he was facing charges of sexual assault and rape against minors. It's very difficult because there's so many layers to this story and so many threads, and the more you dig, the more you find, and it's one of those things where they talk about peeling the onion.
Yeah,
well this is a very, very large onion.
That's
and the
for
more
sure.
we peel, the more we find.
And it is hard to keep it's fascinating and yet hard to keep up with. Let me bring Sean in here because we also want to talk about some other stories, because while much of the media have focused on the race for the White House right now, and deservedly so, some other big stories are happening this week inside the Beltway. Waterboarding, torture or not torture? Legal or not legal? Did we do it or did we not do it? Will the U.S. do it again? Well, the White House says maybe, and Attorney General Mike Mukasey says he won't prosecute those who were involved in waterboarding the last time. So, Sean, to you, how much traction does this story have with the public when we are in the midst of war?
Well, it's hard to gauge, I think, because of, it seems like over the past few years, you know, you're just hit with scandal after scandal, and you know, I don't know if folks are weary or it's become acceptable, and sort of the common thread through all the stories we've been talking about is torture. And so it's just a little bizarre and amazing that we've reached a point in this country where, you know, we're talking a lot about torture, and now what's amazing is in yesterday we find that the president actually okayed the use of waterboarding in at least three cases. And it doesn't seem, I mean, it seems like maybe among Obama supporters it does have some traction, which is probably the reason why he specifically mentioned waterboarding in his Super Tuesday speech the other evening.
What about McCain?
And, well, I guess the interesting thing is, I mean, if you assume McCain is the Republican nominee and both the Democratic nominees, it seems like waterboarding when the Bush administration leaves the White House will be coming to an end as a practice. To me, what's really bizarre about this whole thing is just the history of it. I mean, it really comes out of the, the survival, evasion, and resistance escape schools. That's where U.S. military personnel were trained to resist in waterboarding. And one of the things that is pretty accepted among people who are experts in this thing is that these torture techniques were not designed to elicit truthful information, but they're really designed to elicit confessions. And that's what's so disturbing about the waterboarding that's been taking place.
Are you finding, Gary, in your neck of the woods, that this is an issue people are talking about?
To some degree. I mean, I think everyone around here is much more worried about the economy than any other one single issue, the tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, to that end, then, let's talk about this. The House and Senate have approved a $168 billion economic rescue package, which is headed for the president's desk. He is expected to sign it. That means that approximately 130 million Americans should start receiving checks by spring. So what does that mean for the average citizen, Bob?
Well, I think for a lot of people, they're looking forward to getting the money, especially if you don't make a lot of money. But there's a school of thought with some folks that, well, tax cuts are nice, but with the economy being the way that it is, do we really need that? I mean, let's face it, if I get the money, I'll pay a bill, I'll do something. But I think the whole point of these tax cuts is to stimulate the economy. But people are so far behind on their bills right now because of the way the economy is, I think most of this money is going to be used probably just to pay a bill. It's not going to be used to stimulate the economy.
Well, some believe that is what will stimulate the economy if you spend it on buying something or paying for something. But, Sean, to you, how does this impact the presidential race, if at all, do you think? We've got about a minute.
I think this whole thing is probably more of a political stimulus than it is an economic stimulus. You know, there actually have been studies. The last time this happened, 2001 rebate, you know, there have been studies that were done with what people actually did with their rebates at that time. And, you know, the studies found that lower-income people spent more of the rebates than middle-income people, but higher-income people spent more than middle-income people. And it also showed that household credit card debt, some of these studies show that household credit card debt immediately dropped after the 2001 rebate. So, like Bob, I think, was saying a minute ago, I think a lot of folks who will get the rebate will probably use it to spend on bills. And whether or not that stimulates the economy, I don't know. Maybe this is more of a transfer of wealth to, you know, utility, mortgage, and credit card companies.
Well, look for your check to be in the mail sometime in May, according to the Treasury Secretary. Gentlemen, thank you very much, Bob, Gary, and Sean.
Thank you.
Bob Butler is an independent journalist and president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association. He joined us on assignment in North Carolina. Sean Gonzalez is assistant news editor for the Cape Cod Times. He joined us from his home in Hyannis, Massachusetts. And Gary Harkeye is a reporter for the Charleston Gazette. He spoke with us from his office in Charleston, West Virginia. comedy. In the beginning, it was the only way a black actor could have a significant presence in film. And even today, it's the most common African-American-centered genre you will find at the movies. Today, our series on film continues with a look at what's funny and not so funny about African-American-based cinema. With us is comedian Daryl Littleton. He is the author of the book Black Comedians on Black Comedy, How African-Americans Taught Us to Laugh. He's in studio with me. Also with us is Mark Reed. He is a professor of English and Film and Media Studies at the University of Florida. And Fred McDonald, a cultural historian and CEO of McDonald and Associates, that is a historical film archive in Chicago. Gentlemen, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Let me start off with this first. You know what? Instead of asking you this first question, let's go to a movie first and talk about how, well, let's play the clip. The hit movie Barbershop caused a firestorm of criticism, and it exposed the cultural rift between the civil rights generation and the hip-hop generation. Here's a clip from Barbershop.
The Panthers. You got to give it up to them. You got to give it up to Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, and you got to give it up to Rosa Parks, period.
Okay. Okay.
Because they was deep, and they was on the front line in the
60s. Okay.
Who the hell is Rosa Parks?
Who's Rosa Parks?
She's only the founder of the modern civil rights movement.
Why? What? Because she sat her ass down on the bus?
Come on, Eddie, you know who Rosa Parks is.
Man, she was tired. That's what you do when you're tired. You sit your ass down. I sat down on the bus, and I got thrown in jail. I ain't hear from nobody in a whole week.
Laptops.
I love that movie. I can't help it. Fred,
yes.
Talk about the comedy that existed in that film and put it in a historical context compared to films, you know, earlier in the day.
Well, in a sense, you've gotten more of the subculture of African-American society in the barbershop type of clip. Whereas if you go back to a Bill Cosby type of black comedian in a film, you're really there's some esoteric qualities that people in the African-American community will recognize and laugh at. But for the most part, it's still mainstream comedy. So as we get more and more comfortable with our differences as a society and as African-Americans become increasingly able to attract financial investment in movies aimed at their audience, you will get these kinds of comedy that non-blacks are certainly welcome to join in and laugh with, but it is, you know, aimed specifically at a hip, young, self-confident African-American generation.
Would you say, Mark, that that movie, Barbershop, was a watershed moment for comedy for blacks in film?
Well, I think if we think about the generation within the black community and how it represents, like you mentioned, the hip-hop generation, I think it is a watershed. And even that clip that you presented, the audio track, even though it seemed like it was a criticism, it was really bringing out information about Rosa Parks in a very satirical way, because some of the audience might not have known who Rosa Parks was. So that voice comes in, who she is and what she did, and then with the humor, it says, well, she was just tired. So I think it's a very important film. I think it has, you know, the appeal of my students. They love this film and everything. And with the budget of $12 million, and then getting something like over $75 million, it says it's a crossover.
Well, it certainly does say that it did cost $12 million to make, as you mentioned, grossing $77 million worldwide. The figures that we have, but most of that money that was made domestically. And even though it may have been targeted to the hip hop audience, the question that we will tackle when we come back is with Daryl Littleton is, did it seem to appeal to a wider audience, meaning an older audience? So we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion about African-American comedies past and present. Our guests are Mark Reed, Fred McDonald, and with me in studio, Daryl Littleton.
Say, hey, hey, hey.
Next on News and Notes, more on black comedy on the silver screen, plus Allison Samuels revs us up for the Grammys and tells us about a black modeling vet crying foul over New York's Fashion Week. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're talking African-American film comedies. With us is comedian Daryl Littleton. He is the author of the book Black Comedians on Black Comedy, How African-Americans Taught Us to Laugh. Mark Reed, a professor of English and Film and Media Studies at the University of Florida, and Fred McDonald, a cultural historian and CEO of McDonald and Associates. That's an historical film archive in Chicago. Now, a moment ago, we heard a clip from the movie Barbershop. Before I bring Daryl Littleton in to talk about the wider appeal of black comedies, let's listen to another clip. This one is from a true comedy classic starring Bill Cosby, Sidney Poitier, and Harry Belafonte.
Yeah, why'd you say that in the first place? You dig it? You knock a dude down, you get some respect. See, that's the only way to do it. That's the American way. You understand that? Now, the dude said that Big Percy, Little Seymour's bodyguard, ain't here, so let's go get Little Seymour.
I know you're in here, Seymour, so come on out. I hear you so ugly till the sun refused to shine every time you come out. You so ugly till it's against the law in 20 states to marry you.
Yeah, that's it, Steve. You're cooking. You just keep on talking. He's in here somewhere. And just remember, I got your back. And dig, say something about his mama.
Gotcha.
And you get him.
And, you know, obviously the joke of that was when Little Seymour came out, he was really little, and he whipped some booty that particular day. Daryl Littleton, talk about the wider appeal of comedies. You heard Barbershop. We talked about it as possibly a watershed film, but here we have a film that was 35 years before it, and it was watershed too, I suppose.
Yes, it was, for cast as well as what it presented. It's actually Bill Cosby's first or his only really successful string of movies. Box office-wise, with the ones he did with Sidney Poitier, Bill Cosby, Richard Pryor was in this, Flip Wilson was in this, so they had a fantastic cast. And what they did with the trilogy, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, and A Piece of the Action, they presented black people for black people. And I think that was the main thing that appealed to the wider audience. We didn't water it down. It was pure.
Well, Fred McDonald, before the 1960s, when an African-American played for comic effect, he was very often cooning. Now, that's a term that refers to head-scratching, bubble-eyed, foot-shuffling. Can you think of a film, though, from the early part of the 20th century that was both funny and, shall we say, respectable?
Well, it's really funny because there was a whole world out there of movies made for specifically for black audiences by companies like Astor Pictures, All-American Films, and you can get somebody in there like Step and Fetch It, doing his cooning role that he did in white films. And it's just a funny character. It doesn't have the pejorative, because everybody else around him, the handsome man lead, the handsome woman who's damsel in distress and whatever, they are just normal people. They're African Americans, and then he comes in, Step and Fetch It, for comedy effect. It only takes on its pejorative quality when over and over and over again in white movies, Step and Fetch It is brought in as the only person of color, and he plays that dumb minstrel show-derived cooning character of, you know, shiftless, stupid, lazy, chicken-stealing in an earlier part of the century characterization.
But that's a really tight rope to walk on, isn't it, Daryl Littleton, to be funny and not become a buffoonish minstrel?
Right, but as you just pointed out, minstrel, Step and Fetch It, Burt Williams, all came from that minstrel era or were influenced very closely by the minstrel era. And at that point, that's really all that was being offered. You know, they weren't offering you black doctors or black mathematicians in movies back then.
That's true. Well,
they were in the black-oriented movies.
But not for comedy relief.
No, not for comedy relief. That's true.
Now, by the 1970s, here comes Richard Pryor, and he takes comedy and black comedy in film to a whole nother level. Here's a clip from one of the Richard Pryor classics. It's called Which Way Is Up.
I was right up there with it, Raw Wares and me. I'm gonna be on TV. I wish we had a TV, Pop. Bet I can see myself on television.
Yeah, the gonna be famous, all right. Gonna be the first one to ever see his own funeral on TV.
Let me say that, Pop.
Mean what I said, you got a death wish.
What harm can it be to have my picture in the paper?
That ain't none of your concern. It's twins, them Mexicans and white folk.
Calm down, Daddy. Leroy didn't mean any harm.
Get out of my face. You don't know what the you talking about. And I'll tell you another thing. Somebody stole my piece of chicken.
Richard Pryor was just, you know, he's just the funniest ever. Now, Mark, Richard Pryor's influence has been huge in black comedy and on the new generation of comics that have been following behind him. However, many critics distinguish between the work of Richard Pryor and the work of many of these newcomers. For example, Cat Williams, he's starring in the new film First Sunday. Do you see that big of a difference between the comedy of a Richard Pryor and the more contemporary comedy today of someone like Cat Williams?
Okay, well, I'm not familiar with Cat Williams' work.
Well, let me ask Daryl Littleton, who was here. Daryl, what do you say? We're coming to the end of our time.
Okay, so I will wrap up quickly. The difference basically is time and culture, and I say this with a bit of bias because I'm Cat Williams' personal writer and I didn't try to bait you in anything here, Tony, but yeah, I do work for Cat, and I'm his personal writer and director on that particular movie. The difference is you deal with your time. Richard Pryor broke down a lot of walls. Cat or any other contemporary comedian, those walls have already been broken down. So they're breaking down different walls, just right. Like Burt Williams, just like Red Fox did, Richard Pryor, and so on and so forth. As far as cooning or anything of that nature, I think we're too sensitive in comedy. Comedy's just supposed to be funny. Nobody's scratching their head or gobbling watermelons or chasing chickens anymore or putting down their race, and I think that's one of the main things of cooning.
We have about a minute left. Fred McDonald, is that the same issue today that it was, say, 50 years ago in terms of determining what's appropriate and what is not in black comedy?
I don't really think so anymore. I think that we have, it's there and people can criticize it when it raises its ugly head, but we have so much more integration into our popular cultural output. African Americans, always a very powerful influence on the mainstream, have in many ways dominated in the last so many years with their musical forms, for instance. And I don't think we have the same issues that I had when I wrote my book on the history of blacks on television. It's not the same anymore.
Are we still funny, Daryl Littleton?
Yes, I do think we're still funny.
Are we still funny to you, Fred?
Oh, hilarious.
And Mark?
Oh, yes. I think we have some great young comedians out there. And you know, sometimes they have these shows on Comedy Central, and you see that there's a lot of work being done.
I have to stop you right there. Unfortunately, our time has run out. Daryl Littleton, a comedian and author of the book Black Comedians on Black Comedy. Mark Reed, professor of English and Film and Media Studies at the University of Florida, and Fred McDonald, cultural historian and CEO of McDonald & Associates. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
And now, from the big screen to one of this year's biggest awards shows, they're handing out the Grammys this Sunday night in downtown Los Angeles. But before the stars turn out for that show, they'll be packing it in at any of the dozens of pre-Grammy parties this week. In fact, Alison Samuels was on the scene just last night at a big-time Grammy get-together. She is a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and she is right now with me here in studio to report back about the party. Let me see your eyes.
I'm fine.
You're doing okay.
I'm doing okay.
Well, tell me about the party last night.
The party was great. It was the InStyle party, and it was in conjunction with several artists who have clothing lines like Puffy and Beyonce and Jessica Simpson and people like that. So you had a fashion show, and then Rihanna performed at the end of it, which was the big event of the night because everybody sort of, I think, was there to see Rihanna. I looked on one side of me, and Prince was on one side, and on the other side, Jay-Z was on the other side watching Rihanna perform. So everybody's fascinated by this girl, and she is amazing in person.
I get the impression that she's about to be the next big thing.
I think she's already that. You know, she's on the cover of Cosmo. She was on the cover of Allure. That's really big, particularly as an African-American, to get those mainstream magazines.
She's there already.
She's there, yeah.
Well, the Grammy Awards are coming at a pretty weird time, not to mention the fact that they have really messed up the traffic. Took me an hour to get home yesterday going down past where they're going to be. The Writers Guild is on strike, obviously, still, although they have promised not to picket the awards. Also, the music industry is hurting in CD sales. Was there even a low-key sense of anxiety last night about the show?
It certainly was not the excitement that I usually feel at a pre-Grammy party. That sort of intensity and that sort of, sort of anticipation wasn't there. But I think a lot of that is because most of the parties now are sort of really only having the artists come in. It's not a lot of, they didn't have a lot of time to prepare. So a lot of the parties are just sort of packed with industry people. So I think that's why it was sort of more a little bit low key, but definitely not the same intensity that I usually feel at a Grammy party.
You know what I think would be good? Tell people, what do you do at a Grammy party? I mean, did they talk? Did they sit? Did they dance? I know they eat and drink. I know they do that. But what else goes on there?
Some of us go for the gift bag, which is what I do. But I think that...
What'd you get?
it wasn't as good as I would have liked it to have been. But, you know, whatever. But, people talk. They talk business, if you can hear, because the music is really loud. When Rihanna came on, no one said another word. I mean, everybody was sort of focused on her. But you talk a lot of business. You see people that you haven't seen. And like I said, it's a lot of, people that you've worked with in the past. So a lot of catching up. But... you definitely talk about business because that's, what you're there for in terms of the show. And you're talking about, okay, what does this mean? Who's performing? How that's going to look? Amy Winehouse was like a big discussion last night because of her visa, but now I think she is performing. So you heard a lot of that kind of buzz.
Now, when the Oscars come, some parties, Vanity Fair's party at the Oscars is considered the A party to go to, right? And the one over at Morton's.
Right.
Is there an A party for the Grammys?
Clive Davis usually has a pre-Grammy party, and I hadn't really heard anything about one this year, but he may be having it. But that's usually the biggest one where every celebrity goes, and everyone who's anyone actually goes, music or otherwise. So that one, and it's always at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and it's a very nice event. So that's probably the one that you want to get invited to for the Grammys.
One more Grammy question before we talk about fashion. Any surprises in the show this year?
I think it'd be interesting to see, how many awards Kanye wins, and hopefully he will win some so he won't get upset. And, just following his mother's death, I think it's going to be a whole different sort of vibe with him as well. And just sort of watching, Amy Winehouse as she does perform. I just want to see how that's going to work out for everybody.
All right, let's talk fashion. Okay. Speaking of blacks in and out of the fashion world, Spotlight, the veteran model and agent Beth Ann Hardison is on the industry's case again. Apparently, she and others are criticizing the way New York's Fashion Week has gone down this week. What's up with that?
Well, the African-American model has definitely sort of disappeared from the runway. And in many ways, minority models overall have disappeared, but in particularly the African-American model. And so what Beth Ann has been doing for the last couple of months is sort of having these sort of town hall discussions on, what can we do? What happened? Because it used to be that fashion was ahead of the game. They always had, you had Naomi Sims, you had people like that were Beverly Johnson back in the 70s that were hip and were on the cover of Vogue. So now it seems like it's, sort of we're regressing in fashion, and you don't see those models. All the models seem to look very much alike from Sweden or something. They have that same look, same bill, nothing at all diverse about it. And I think what her question is how do we stop this? I don't know if there's an answer. I think the actual designers have to stop it. When I go to shows and I don't see black models, that I put that in my head and say, okay, do I really want to buy this person's merchandise because he's not acknowledging me, so why would I acknowledge him?
So where are all these models, black models, who are winning on America's Next Top Model?
They're not getting work. Yeah, they're not working. I mean, if they're doing, they may have a spot in a film or a commercial or something like that. But as far as doing the runway shows, which is a lot of money, that's not happening for them. And that is what real modeling is, doing the runway shows, really.
All right, let's talk about somebody else. All right, I saw this on television, but the sound was down.
Okay.
And I admit I did not hear it. But when I saw him sitting there with Larry King, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Snoop Dogg interviewed with Larry King, talking about politics.
Yes.
Is he doing a makeover? What's up with him?
Well, I think that, Snoop has always been an incredibly popular person with everybody, mainstream included. And I think that what he's tried to do is just capitalize on that. And in capitalizing, he's become more and more, sort of, you know, more and more mainstream, I guess is what it is. Because when he first came out, it was totally rap. It was totally sort of hardcore. He was arrested and put on trial for murder. But he's been able to sort of really transition from that hardcore guy to, you know, the family man.
Well, I tell you what, to make your point, we have a clip from that interview, I believe. Okay. And we're going to play it right now. This is Snoop Dogg and Larry King.
I just want to see somebody win that's in the best interest of America, whether it be him, a black man, whether it be Hillary or a woman. Either one, to me, is a great move for America because we need change. We need somebody in there that's going to be about listening to the people and representing the people. And I feel like both of those candidates will do that.
No gin and juice, not even one time
no,
in that conversation.
No, he's growing up. I mean, you know, Snoop is getting older. He has three kids. I think, you know, he's like in his late 30s now. So, I mean, I think it's he's evolving as we all want our celebrities to do, if possible, and ourselves to do. So I think he's growing up. So I think that's the really cool part about Snoop.
Will his audience that has followed him, and we're about 30 seconds left, will the audience that has followed him follow him to this next
persona? I think
people
are fascinated by him enough where they would keep looking. I think he's like, you know, this car wreck underway where you just want to keep seeing what's going on with him. So, yeah, I think people will pay attention. They'll stay tuned.
That's very interesting. I appreciate it, Allison.
Thank you.
Allison Samuels is a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, joining me here at our NPR West studios. Always a pleasure. Have
Thank
fun at
you.
The Grammys.
Thank you.